With our special guest tonight, Bob Kern, we're talking about man-made monsters. We're going to talk about some past and present monsters in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Bob. Tell me about these creatures called Golem.
Well, George, the Golem comes out of Hebrew tradition. And we'll talk a wee bit more about that in a moment.
Okay.
But the ancient peoples believed, the ancient Hebrews believed that before Jehovah created our ancestor Adam, the first man, he had made a number of prototypes, one of whom was Adam Kadmon. Now, these were all imperfect and were rejected. The perfect creation was our ancestor, Adam. Adam Kadmon was apparently made, all had been made from clay of the earth. And Adam Kadmon was apparently a great hulking figure made out of clay, which was humanoid, but which had a limited intelligence. And the Supreme Creator, or Jehovah, destroyed them all. But the Golem was Adam Kadmon was the prototype of what became known as the Golem. Now, the ancient rabbis asked the question, as did everybody else, would it be possible to create life using some secret or some formula which had been used by the Supreme Creator to create even an imperfect life? And the answer seemed to be yes, it could, because they believed that perhaps Jehovah had confided to the patriarch Abraham some sort of secret by which life could be created. And this was supposedly written down. And it was written in a book called the Sefer Yetzirah, which means the Book of Formation. This book was supposed, or copies thereof, were supposed to be circulating in medieval Europe around the late 13th, 14th centuries. Now, and they were directly attributed to the patriarch Abraham. It's probably not, they're probably medieval scripts, but they were supposedly gave directions on how to create life, on how to create a human figure which would live, albeit imperfectly.
Now, were these creatures, the Golem, were they I guess, were they harmful to others, or were they good?
Well, the original intention was, and here we once again we see the split or the ambivalence. They were could only be created by rabbis who were pure in thought and deed, and there was a great ritual surrounding them. It was not simply saying a magic word and the Golem popped up. There was a great ritual which had to be observed for a period beforehand. I mean, there has to be fasting, prayer, all the ordinary things, and various tasks to be undertaken before you could actually come to create a Golem. And they were supposedly to be created for good, and they were supposedly to be created for only a short time to do specific good for the rabbi. Now, many rabbis were supposed to use them as servants or to help with attending the sick or whatever. But if you kept the Golem in existence for too long, it began to develop traits of its own. The Golem originally was supposed to be a blank, almost like a blank canvas or a blank, book.
And what did they look like?
And could be instructed by the rabbi, who instructed it for good.
Describe what they look like, Bob, if you would, too.
They were, there are various descriptions of them. Some of them were that they were simply great, almost mobile lumps of clay. Some people, some descriptions give them almost as people. And some people give them terrific height, like they could grow and become giants. Some said that they were like dwarves. So there is no clear description as to the golem. What we do know is that they had eyes, a nose, and a mouth. And because the mouth was particularly important, because what you did was you could write a certain holy word on a clay tablet and place it under the golem's tongue. And that motivated the golem. That brought the golem to life. The word, George, if I can reveal it over the airways, is emeth. Which meant in ancient Hebrew, truth. Now, in order to destroy the golem, all you had to do was destroy the first aleph, or letter of that. You took away the E, and you were left with meth, which meant unformed, or rubbish, or waste material. And that destroyed the golem. And you were supposed to do that after a certain time. Now, if you didn't do that, the golem began to develop thoughts and prejudices of its own. And this is where the fascinating part of the golem legend comes in, because what you're getting is prejudice beginning to come in. It is thought that if the golem were left unattended, it would attack people. And coming back to your original question, was it for good or evil? It would attack mainly Christians, because Christians were different to Jews, and this could be used by the Jews to attack Christian areas. And in certain areas, Jews and Christians lived cheek by jowl, but were not terribly happy neighbors. It became almost a metaphor, and we talked about metaphors before. The golem almost became a metaphor for a Jewish threat. If the golem was left unattended or left for too long, it would go into Christian areas and would attack and perhaps even kill Christians. And the idea of the golem became almost a metaphor for a Jewish monster lurking perhaps in cities like Prague in the West, and may well have given rise to ideas among Christians, and certainly did, of anti-Semitism, and that the Jews were harboring a golem or golems in order to attack Christian people. And that was the basis of the great legend of the Golem of Prague.
What do we know about alchemists and what they did?
Well, this is another area where, as I say, superstition and science begin to blur and meld together. Because alchemists were actually the forerunners of modern chemistry. And the alchemist is where we get the word chemist from. So we're getting a sort of blurring. Now, the alchemists began to look for various things. They were early scientists, if you like. They looked mainly for three mystical things. They were tied up with mysticism. They were tied up with allegedly tied up with mysticism and the occult. Part of this may have been propaganda. Some of them certainly believed that they were trying to find certain things, certain mystical things. They searched for three things. The first was the Philosopher's Stone. Now, if you know your Harry Potter, you will know about the Philosopher's Stone, and you will know about the main man who searched for it, and that was Nicholas Flamel in 14th century France. So the Philosopher's Stone was a thing, an element which turned base metal into gold, was greatly allegedly sought after. The second thing they sought was the Emerald Tablet. Now, the Emerald Tablet was an element in which a number of grains could be dropped into a drink, and if you drank that, it would increase your lifespan. And there were certain people who were said to be immortal because they had drunk of the Comte de Saint-Germain, for example. The third thing, and most importantly from this book aspect, was that they thought they would search for a seed from which a man could be grown, like a plant, and they could create life. And they began to look at things in alembics and jars, which were supposed to be the basis of life and to grow people. Now, that was interestingly politically, because if you could grow a man, as some alchemists claimed they could,
like you would grow a plant,
you had a basic seed which you could place in certain nutrients, and the man would grow from it. But if you could grow a man, then you could also grow an army. Some of these alchemists were privately financed, and perhaps secretly financed, by nobles, by emperors, by kings, by counts of the time. Now, whether or not they could do that is open to question, but the reputation, if you had a man working with you who claimed he could grow you an army, and your enemies knew about that, then they would think twice about attacking you, and it would give you great political prestige in whatever area you lived. So the alchemists worked in this area. Of course, as we mentioned before, they often had to work in secret, because their greatest opponent was the church. So they wrote their experiments down in something like code, in stories. For instance, the most famous is The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosencrantz, which is supposed to be an alchemical experiment couched in the form of a story in which a man goes to a wedding, and the guests give him various things along the way. And this is actually putting together some sort of secret which the alchemists had discovered. Now, the alchemists did not work for, let's say, monetary gain, although some of them did become quite wealthy because of their patrons. But they were working for what was called the gnosis. That's an old Greek word meaning knowledge. And simply, they were like scientists working to push back the frontiers of science and chemistry and things like that. Now, a lot of them didn't find the things that they were looking for, but they did produce the basis of experiments which we use today. And in a sense, they were the forerunner of the modern chemical scientists. It is said that they could produce stuff like a fog, right, which could make men fall asleep, which might be some form of nerve gas, and although it was not couched in those terms. So you also had brotherhoods of alchemists working together, because these coded messages passed among them, and they formed brotherhoods. The most famous were the Rosicrucians.
Behind all these stories, there's got to be a basis of truth here. I mean, it's just either every culture is making these things up, as you say, metaphors, myths, or something's going on here, and I'm beginning to think that there was some creation going on here.
Well, George, I would tend to agree with you because I always say that within every myth, there is the seed of reality. And I think that things have been happening in the past that we don't know about, or that we have blotted out, or that we have conveniently forgotten about. And I think that I tend to agree with you that there are perhaps things which have been going on in the past which were, dare I say, even better not knowing about. And we think we are quite modern, and we're talking about robots, we're talking about cloning, we're talking about this, we're talking about that. But it says, I think, in the Bible, that there is nothing new under the sun. So I suspect that things have been happening in the past that perhaps we're better off not knowing about.
Well, that could be. The ideas of ancient robots back in the Greek, Roman, and early Chinese cultures. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, this leads on from what I've just said. We tend to look back at our ancestors, and you and I have talked about this before, George. We tend to look back at our ancestors and say they weren't terribly advanced. We are sort of the pinnacle of civilization as we know it. And that's a lot of bunkum, because the ancient civilizations were just as advanced as we were in many respects. Now, we look at computers and we say, oh, this is the computer age, and as if it had never existed before. But computers did exist, and computers existed in classical times. And we know that because we have found one in the early 1900s, in around about 1900 itself. A mechanism, the Antikythera mechanism, was found off the coast of Antikythera in Greece. Antikythera is a small island. And it was brought up from the wreck of a Roman ship. And it was a workable computer. Very basic, but certainly in terms that we would recognize. And we believe that it was used in the defense of part of the Greek states, and that it was one of two massive computers which were designed by the mathematician Archimedes, who was a Greek. It finished up on a Roman ship because there had been a war between the Greeks and the Romans, and the general Marcellus was bringing it back to Rome. And his ship was driven off course and wrecked, and the mechanism went down with it.
They were advanced, Bob. They were advanced. You know, people don't give them credit for that.
They certainly do not, George. The ancient Babylonians, for example, had batteries and used battery power. We also suspect that the ancient Chinese had some sort of quarrying device. There is reference to a creature known as the Chai Yu, which
Let's get into the Chinese bit of that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. You can go to our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Lex is going to post a YouTube video of a ancient Greek computer. It's kind of neat. Bob, you were talking about the Chinese. How advanced were they, and how much experimenting did they do with these man-made creatures?
The Oriental peoples had experimented a great deal. Now, there is reference to a creature, and I use the word in inverted commas, known as the Chai Yu, which lived in the inhospitable mountains. And it was supposedly a dragon. And once again, I use that word in inverted commas. It ate rock and excreted rock. But the rock that it excreted was chomped up or broken down. And what we think it actually was a sort of computer-operated quarrying machine. We say that, or they said that the Chiyu died, which means that possibly its power source ran out. Now, we don't know exactly when that creature lived, if you like, but we suspect that it was in prehistoric, that is, before written records, times, and it comes down to us in legends. We also know that for entertainment, a number of Chinese emperors and a number of ancient Japanese emperors were supposed to have mechanical orchestras, and that they were automated monks who collected for charity. These were sort of like moving statues which stood on street corners, and you dropped something into the bowl which it held out, and the monk bowed and said thank you. And people queued up to see this. But there were orchestras, there were birds, there were animals which could actually move, and these all came from the Far East. And we know that even in the Middle East, there was work going on, and there were supposed to be, and you've mentioned it, ancient computers, the Antikythera mechanism, which I assume you're putting up on your site. Mm-hmm. And we suspect that there were much more of these, and there were designs for much more of these, which were destroyed when Julius Caesar attacked the Great Library at Alexandria in AD 48, and burned many of the manuscripts there. Some of these manuscripts were said to contain references both from the Middle East and from the Far East of devices which were automated, and of early computers which were designed by the Greeks. So you have an entire ancient tradition of mechanical devices and automatons. The word robot, as you know, did not come into our language until around about 1921, when it appeared in a play by the Czech playwright Karel Čapek. But robots and automatons and living statues, if you like, were in evidence all across the ancient Eastern world, all across the ancient Mediterranean world. So, as we said earlier, George, the ancients were much more advanced than we give them credit for.
I think so, too. Now, you've also looked into, moving ahead a little bit, Area 51 in Nevada. What do you think's going on there, Bob?
Well, a good question, George. People keep asking me what's going on in Nevada, and people keep sending me stuff, and people have said, what do you think of this? For instance, I got something from, I think it was Quebec, not so long ago, which was whenever I was doing this book, and somebody knew I was doing the book and sent me something, which said that somewhere in the United States, whether it was Area 51 or somewhere else, or maybe even in South America, that they were beginning to work on creating soldiers with animal genes in them. They were sort of crossbreeding between men and animals. And they had cloned a man with some jaguar DNA in him to make him particularly fierce to make him fight better. And the question was, well, where are we going now? We don't know what's going on in Area 51. They say there's cloning going on. They say alien technology is being used from as far back as Roswell in the 1940s. Your guess, George, is as good as mine. We don't know what's going on, but they keep saying there's something strange going on there. So you never know what they're creating. It said that they're developing stuff for the military. So we may get the new sort of super soldier coming out. And, I mean, you and I both know that the super soldier has been sort of fascinating us very recently. I mean, even as far back as the Second World War, you have, and I don't know whether you're a great comics fan, George, but you have Captain America, who was the super soldier, and I think you'll get a film about him very soon. You've also had a look at the Wolverine, who is a sort of adapted man-made creature. So it's beginning to fascinate us, and we're looking towards Area 51, and they're saying, is that what's really going on there? Are they creating something like a Captain America or the Wolverine there?
Well, you know what? Something's going on. There's no question about it. It's a secretive place, and who knows what. When you look at all these creatures worldwide, myths, metaphors, reality, are you convinced that there could be like an island of Dr. Moreau out there somewhere, Bob, where all these aberrations are just, they're all over the place?
I think, George, that there may well have been experiments carried on. There were experiments carried on in America and places like that. I mean, one of the things which, whenever I was saying, let's think about this for the book, we had talked about things like the melon heads, which were alleged genetic experiments with children in an orphanage in Ohio. And some of them are said to have escaped and are living in the wild somewhere. The location sometimes shifts from Ohio to Wyoming to places like that. So there may well have been places where experiments are carried on, and I think that with the adoption of various soldiers, I mean, our notion of war, George, is beginning now to change. We are looking back towards the First and Second World Wars, and these were massive global conflicts. But those are the wars of the past. The wars of the present are slightly more complex. They're in various theaters in the world, and we have talked about that. We have talked about Afghanistan. We have talked about Bosnia. And who knows, there's talk that there may be fighting in the Korean Peninsula. We don't know. But it can flare up anywhere. And we need, it is thought, to create some soldier or a warrior who can be adapted to those very different theaters. And we talked about that sort of generally slightly earlier. And I think there may have been experiments carried on in the past to develop even in the 1800s, when war, 1800s, when there was great wars all across Europe, to develop some form of soldier or some form of person who could fight in those wars, and I think that is still the case. That there are something, whether it be an island like Dr. Moreau, or whether it be a sort of laboratory somewhere in the wilds of Nevada or somewhere like that, there may well have been, and there may well be, experiments still being carried on to adapt and modify people. The other thing which we're looking at is that people are may be adapted to life in space. I mean, let's say a man goes to Mars. He's in a or to the moon. He's in a weightless atmosphere. So he, that's going to have an effect on his body. So he needs to be adapted for that. A man goes into the depths of the ocean, and we're beginning to look at exploring the ocean because we know less about the ocean than we know about outer space. So men are going to go down into various deep parts of the ocean, and they're going to be subject to immense pressure. They need to be adapted for that. Men are going to, we are looking at new nanotechnology. Could men have tiny robots placed within them to clear out fatty deposits or which creates heart disease? Or could new chemical elements change us so that we are resistant to certain diseases? And I think that has always been the notion that men could be modified in order to suit their environment. And as the environment changes, so we need to be modified to deal with it. Now, that's the upside. The downside is if we modify ourselves too much, what do we make ourselves? Do we lose humanity? And there are stories of cyborgs and creatures like that in science fiction who are the true monsters who can turn against us, who have all sorts of powers and weaponry at their disposal.
I can't let the night go by without talking to you briefly, Bob, about leprechauns before we get into phone calls.
It wouldn't be an interview with George Norrie if we didn't talk about leprechauns.
I tell you, they fascinate me. I've been fascinated with them since I saw the Darby O'Gill and the Little People movie. What the heck? What the heck are these things?
No. You're getting into the wrong sort of genre whenever you're talking about Darby O'Gill and the Little People, because they're, you're making an Irishman's heckles rise, because it's all sort of what I call paddy whackery. Leprechauns. The term leprechaun has only been in use since the 1700s. There are various notions of small people. The leprechaun can be a number of things. They can be a remnant of old nature spirits, which were worshipped at a time. But what I think, because one of the terms which is used in Gaelic for leprechaun also means pygmy. And what I suspect, and it's a personal viewpoint, these are a race memory of another race. We've talked about man-made monsters, and I'm trying to link it in, but nature has taken some twists of her own. And we do know that there were other types of human being. For instance, we know that there were Neanderthals. And very recently in the Philippines, they have unearthed skeletons of very small people. So it may be a race memory of another type of human being or another type of man which lived and gradually has died out. And so it may be sort of old spirits, it may be old gods, it may be an explanation of the landscape around us, the old mounds, the old hollows, the sacred trees, things like that, or it may be a race memory of another type of people who once shared this planet with us and may still do so.
That may be it. Truly may be it. Why do they have, or seem to have, mystical powers?
Well, we attribute sort of all sorts of weird things to things we don't understand or that we are not fully cognizant with. We ascribe all sort of strange powers to certain people that we are slightly frightened of. We say they're witches, we say they're black magicians, things like that. It is thought that possibly they, for instance, here in Ireland, one of the names for the early fairies were the Tuatha De Danann, who were bronze-skinned and who came from the east in a golden cloud. This is named in a 12th century book called The Book of Invasions, or The Book of the Taking of Ireland. And details a number of invasions which came, are supposed to have come. And these are, these may well have been Greeks or something, some similar race, who had powers of healing, who had different ways about them. And because we didn't understand them, we attributed mystical powers because maybe they had ways of healing which we didn't know about, and therefore we tended to look at them as magical. We have talked about Frankenstein. There's an element of magic in that as well, because whenever Mary Shelley was writing it, we take electricity for granted. We think nothing of switching on a light, switching on and off our televisions, switching on and off our vacuum cleaners. But in Mary Shelley's day, electricity was still something very mystical. And
she used it brilliantly,
magical.
By the way. In her book, she used it brilliantly, didn't she?
Sorry?
In her works, she used it brilliantly.
Oh, she used it brilliantly indeed. But remember that whenever somebody like Giovanni Aldini, was on whom I think Frankenstein is based, was conducting his experiments and trying to raise money for his experiments, Aldini was a showman, and he conducted mystical shows, which nobody truly understood, using electricity. For example, one of his favorite tricks was kissing the electric virgin. And what he got was a young lady, and whom he gave a mild charged her with electricity, very mildly, placed her on a certain insulated mat, and got young men to come up and kiss her, and they got an electric shock.
They got zapped. Let's talk a little bit more about that, Bob. And when we come back, well, not only will we take your phone calls with Dr. Bob Curran, but how about some of your monster stories? I'm sure you have one. We'll be back.